Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Hello and welcome to Project Zion, the Restoration Caffeinated. Today is the second podcast in a new international series, Grounds for Peace, under the auspices of peaceprojects.eu. In this series, we are asking, what are the grounds, and you might even say the foundations for a new peaceful humanity? I'm your host, Joey Williams, member of the Community of Christ European Peace and Justice Team and Mission Center President for the Western Europe Mission Center. According to Steve Veazey, President of Community of Christ, no matter where we start as individuals, our calling, our purpose as a human species is to be a peaceful humanity. The phrase peaceful humanity is another way of saying Zion, God's peaceful reign on earth where everything is right. Today, our guest is Andrew Bolton, and he's with us to have a further discussion on dehumanization. Andrew lives in Leicester, England with his wife, Jewel Holmes, and has a special passion for peace and justice. He has worked as a religious education teacher in Leicester and a teacher trainer at Westminster College, Oxford. He worked for Community of Christ for 18 years, part of that time coordinating the Peace and Justice Ministries and Department of the entire International Church, and then 9 years with the task of coordinating the spiritual and pastoral care of 215 congregations in mission in 10 different countries. He has just written a second book on the Sermon on the Mount called Learning on the Mountain, Serving in the Valley, and is looking for a publisher. He has written and co-authored other books, including In Pursuit of Peace, Community of Christ Journey, available at www.heraldhouse.org. Recently, Andrew has written a number of essays on conscientious objectors in World War I, and also about early church history, including the British Isles. Andrew, I'm so glad you could join us today to continue this important discussion about dehumanization. Please say hello to our listeners.
Hello. I'm very pleased to be with you and our listeners today, Joey.
It's good to have you today. Andrew, you and some of your friends recently gave a webinar on dehumanization yesterday and today, how to act as neighbor, as part of the 2020 European Peace Colloquy webinar series. And our listeners can access this webinar at www.peaceprojects.eu or on the Community of Christ Europe YouTube page. So tell us, what is dehumanization and what makes you so passionate about this issue?
I think there's two ways I'd like to begin. One, first of all, is to say that I'm still haunted by World War II, where my dad was a soldier for 7 years, and World War II in our family didn't end in 1945. It ended in 1965, 20 years later, when my dad began to get help. So a lot of my energy for peace and justice comes from the stories of his dreadful experiences in World War II. So in Europe, we have to be serious about war. And secondly, dehumanization, which was your question. Dehumanization is to be picked on, bullied, be put down, belittled, stereotyped. Dehumanization is racism, sexism. And we all experience dehumanization. When it happens to me, I have this sinking feeling, confusion, sense of fear or worry. It's not a pleasant experience. And at the same time, we're all made in the glorious image of God. There's something in me that protests this treatment. And we can and should resist our dignity being taken away. And we should resist the dignity of others being attacked.
Yeah, so there's this question of dignity, the worth of others, and standing up basically for others and with others anytime their dignity is at risk. Is that right?
Yeah.
So you started your presentation on dehumanization talking about some stories from a book called East West Street by Philippe Sands. And your college friend Miles Hillman had given you a copy of this and then invited you to join him in Lviv in the Ukraine to follow the story on the ground. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about this book, about the trip you went on? What was it that hooked you or grabbed your attention and made you go on this trip? And what did you get out of it?
So over 50 years ago, Miles and I met at an agricultural college in the south of England. We're both northerners. In fact, we find out later that our families knew each other historically.
Really?
So, yeah, that's very cool. But anyway, we hit it off before we knew about that. And we both ended up in Leicester. This is where our families both came. And we met. We'd lost touch. He came to our wedding. We lost touch, and then we met in Victoria Park, Leicester. Now, his dad's story is important and inspiring to both of us. So let's hear Miles tell that story of his dad.
So why was I fascinated? Well, I am the son of a refugee. My father was German. He was driven out of Germany by anti-Semitism and by Nazism. He was not Jewish. In the 1920s, he was apprenticed as a carpenter in the Kiel shipyards, unable to afford further education. He nonetheless studied at the Volkshochschule in the evenings and eventually passed and gained a scholarship at the Christian Albrechtshaus at Kiel University. In 1933, his Jewish professor, Professor Coleman, was expelled from Kiel University. This expulsion led to a furious argument between my father and the leader of the Nazi students, a certain Klaus Huckner. At the end of which, Klaus Huckner said to my dad, "Herr Hillman, you need re-educating." The next day, he was arrested, sent to a camp on the island of Sylt, where hard labor during the day was combined with learning Mein Kampf in the evenings. After a few months in the camp, he was deemed to have learned Mein Kampf well enough that he was allowed out of the camp for a weekend. But rather than go home, he headed north to Esbjerg, where he managed to stow away on a fishing boat bound for Arbroath in Scotland. He was welcomed to Scotland. My brother and my sisters and I are really appreciative of the welcome the UK gave him as a refugee. We are proud of his personal fight against totalitarianism and racism, and we do not forget it. Hopefully, my siblings and I have made a contribution as midwife, engineer, businessman, and social worker, and none of us have yet been convicted of any heinous crimes, which demonstrates, in a small way, the value to British society of welcoming refugees. Thank you.
So Philip Sands tells brilliantly the story of the Nazi Holocaust in the city of Lviv in the Ukraine. Philip Sands' grandfather was born there. He also tells the story of two lawyers who studied in Lviv and went on to make extraordinary contributions to international law. Philip Sands is a professor of international law at University College London and writes a true story, but like a novel. The result is a monumental achievement. Is profoundly personal, it's gripping, it's told with love, anger, and great precision. And no novel could possibly match it as an important work of truth. So if you want an easy introduction to human rights law and why it matters, national and international human rights law, this is a really good introduction to that. And Miles and I went to Lviv to follow the story on the ground. And by doing that, the story became even more real for us because of the things we saw, the stories we heard, the death camp we visited, the railway station by the ghetto on which Jews went to Belzec and so on. So it's the sacrament of place that augmented the story for Miles and I.
Yeah, of course, anytime you can make a visit, and especially after having read this book, that you were able to like kind of live that moment even years later, right?
Yeah, and our two guides were awesome as well. So Peter, the organizing guide, had read Philip Sands' book, put this tour together, and his German, and his critical German of what his forebears did in this story. So part of the tour was Peter's authenticity and commitment to telling of this story truthfully and honestly. And then there was Marie, a Ukrainian PhD, who also was caught by this story and was also a very helpful guy. So the people that we had with us were part of our journey.
Yeah, and brought it to life in many ways.
Yeah.
So did you already know about Dr. Gregory Stanton's model of the 10 stages of genocide before that trip?
I did.
Dr. Gregory Stanton is the president of Genocide Watch at www.genocidewatch.com and explains on that website 10 different stages of genocide. So tell us more about that and why that is helpful for us to know.
So genocide doesn't happen by accident. It's a deliberate, planned process of mass killing of a whole group of people. And when we understand each step or stage, we can then prepare how we can intervene and disrupt and block the process. We can recognize its beginnings and take action early on to hinder this terrible process, of creation of hell for people.
Yeah, and later in this podcast, I hope we can really focus on some of that intervention. At what points can we step in to not allow the process to continue? And this is actually dehumanization. That word is found at the fourth stage of Dr. Stanton's model. And so that's only one of nine other stages. So why did you focus your presentation on dehumanization as opposed to one of the other stages in that model?
So yes, Dr. Stanton calls stage four dehumanization. And in this stage, he describes how members of a group are called vermin, cockroaches, rats, and therefore more easily killed or murdered.
Not seeing people as human at all, to the point that we can then do something about it to get rid of them.
Yes, and this happened to Jews in World War II, Bosnian Muslims, Rwanda Tutsi. So calling members of a group worse than subhuman justifies then killing them or makes it easier to kill them. However, each stage of Stanton's 10-step model of genocide is actually a step of dehumanization. So the first step, stereotyping, classifying people, is a process of dehumanization, marking them out with the Star of David, or in the case of race, by the color of a person's skin, then discriminating against them, culminating in murder. So murder is dehumanization big time. So each of his stages are stages actually of dehumanization. And the last step of genocide is denial. So we even erase the memory of the person, of what happened. So his whole model is a process of describing the process of dehumanization that leads to genocide.
So I get that part of dehumanization obviously is horrible and bad, but the first two stages are classification and symbolization. And these are things to me that seem like very human traits. You know, even both of the creation stories in the Bible, categorize, classify, name, seem to give some type of hierarchy to the order of creation. So is it always bad, or is it some type of combination of classification and symbolization with something else? You know, is something else added that leads us down a path of genocide? What are the factors of these two steps in the stage of discrimination that eventually lead us to dehumanization?
So we as humans are classifying and symbolizing all the time. That's how we manage the world, understand the world. The periodic table is a classification of all the elements, right? I love plants. So the division of plants into different families, helps in identification of them, and so on. The problem is that when we apply it to humans, we make a human a thing or an it. A rock is already an it, a plant, arguably so. But when we make humans an it, then we've dehumanized them. So in my comics, as a boy, a Frenchman was often pictured riding on a bicycle with horizontal striped sweater, wearing a beret, having a mustache, and a garland of onions around his neck. So we call this stereotyping. And it can be funny, but I might feel a little uncomfortable and disturbed if I was to read French boy comics portraying the English. The thing is, each of us as humans are unique and different. Everybody expects me in the United States to drink tea as an English person, but I don't drink tea. I bust the stereotype. Outsiders mimic a London Cockney accent to stereotype how an English person speaks, or perhaps a very posh, upper-class English accent. I speak neither. So when I'm stereotyped in a negative way, I feel condemned, trapped, found guilty before I've done anything. It's a terrible place to be in, because I can't argue my way out. So classifying people is to dehumanize them. It attacks the unique image of God in a person. It destroys their dignity. In the Nazi forced labor camps, you were reduced to a number. You had it tattooed on your arm. Even your name, Joey or Andrew, was taken away. Now, I had all kinds of negative stereotypes of Americans growing up, right, which I confess with some awkwardness now. However, I married an American, but I didn't marry a stereotype. I married Jewel, a unique Jewel, 43 years ago. And Jesus, if I may say so, ends humans classifying each other. Paul, in his letter to Ephesians, says that Jesus removed the wall of hostility between Jews and Gentiles. In his letter to the Galatians, he writes that in Christ, in God, there's neither Jew nor Gentile, neither slave nor free, neither male nor female. And the parable of the Good Samaritan is a stereotype-busting story. If I was to add a new commandment to the Ten Commandments, it would be, thou shalt not stereotype.
Yeah, so it's almost over and over again that we continue to try not to see the other as other, right? It seems that the closer we bring others into being human, being more like us as opposed to different from us, or to negatively see them as different, that we can kind of make them more human. Is that where this is going?
Yeah, and I found that when I went to work in Germany as a college student. It was a big thing for me to do after my dad's 7 years in World War II. And this is one of my big, big discoveries. Wherever I go in the world, I encounter a real human being, no matter their race, their language, their religious background. And that's a huge and important discovery. Some of my best friends are in Japan, soulmates, and the Philippines and so on. So that's one of my big, big discoveries. You can encounter a human wherever you go, in whatever culture, and of whatever race.
Wonderful. So when obviously this doesn't happen, when it goes the opposite way, when probably led by our fear, we continue to push people into another category or see them as outsiders, that it leads to these really scary words that you keep using, like Holocaust and genocide. And, you know, these are dark subjects, very difficult subjects. Why is it so important for us to face it?
So for a European, this happened in our backyard. World War I, World War II. There's memories of that all over the place. Every English village, every English town, city has war memorials. put up after World War I. So you can't escape the consciousness of the terribleness of World War I. And when I go to the village where my parents lived for 38 years, I know some of the names, the family names on that war memorial that don't have children in the valley anymore because they died as young men. And then World War II and my dad's stories, being at Dunkirk, North Africa, ending the war in Italy. I mean, it disturbed his mind. So that's when World War II's in the home. And then Holocaust and genocide, 11 million people died, 6 million of them Jewish. It's really important to face this because it's part of the European reality. And I want to say that we have some language in Christianity to help us deal with this. Crucifixion Friday happens to innocent people every day. It's a reality and we must face it. And in the darkness of Crucifixion Friday, I suggest Christians are the most realistic of all people about the human condition, that we humans can do terrible things to each other. In the crucifixion story of Jesus, we murder God, our creator, our mother and father. The dreadful betrayal that's in the Holocaust is of people from a Christian culture crucifying Jewish women, men, and children. That's so difficult for European Christians to come to terms with, but really important. However, there's more to the Christian sense of reality than darkness, than Crucifixion Friday or genocide. If we only had that part of the story, we would give up. But it's in the early morning light of Resurrection Sunday, of seeing with the women an empty tomb, that we begin to realize that God is able to mend and heal and bring to wholeness what is broken. And a day is coming, says the last book of the Bible, in its penultimate chapter, that God will wipe away every tear from every eye. So Christians in the awful, tragic reality of Crucifixion Friday are the most realistic of people about sin, our inhumanity to one another, and to injustice. But this is only half the story. In the early morning light, 3 days later, we join the women and find an empty tomb. So Christians are also the most hopeful of people. Our tears and fears can change to songs of joy and well-being. And this, then, is the really important line. Our task is this: to stop the crucifixion machine in our world and be a part of God's healing and mending.
So when you talk about this crucifixion machine, obviously you're making now a connection to dehumanization that leads to murder, right? And potentially mass murder of entire groups of people. So you've talked about that, obviously, in Europe, the heart of that issue is the Holocaust experience. So is dehumanization continuing today? Is this crucifixion machine still at work?
Indeed, I'm afraid it is. And it's threatening again in Europe. I never thought this would come back. I thought fascism, the far right, was a thing of the past. We had made it history. But people are forgetting. So hate speech, for instance, is alive and well. And here's one example from a British newspaper website, the Sun in Britain, by Victor Young, heading Migrants. Quote, "Send them back where they come from. Bunch of cockroaches trying to invade." There's one sample of hate speech. The rise of populist leaders who victimized minorities, migrants, refugees, blacks, Muslims, homosexuals, and Jews are on the increase. We thought the far right was over in Europe after the terrible things that happened in World War II. But in France, we have Marine Le Pen, France's National Front leader. In Britain, Tommy Robinson and Nigel Farage. In Germany, there's Alternative für Deutschland. Viktor Orban is president of Hungary. And there's Donald Trump in the United States. And perhaps to connect more about what's really happening in Britain at the moment, we can hear the testimony of David Forbes, a Quaker from Birmingham, talk about the intentional, explicit policy of the British, current British government on treating migrants and refugees. This policy is called by the British government hostile environment. So over to you, David.
In this pandemic, in this time of Black Lives Matter and of Greta Thunberg, it's hard to imagine anyone using a hostile environment as a selling point. But that's what Theresa May, the then UK Home Secretary, did in 2012. Unfortunately, we are still living with the dehumanizing consequences of this today. Its most striking manifestation for me is a new style poll tax on migrants and refugees in the UK, which is disguised as government fees. Take the example of Moat and Babel, a refugee couple from Ethiopia. As their registered legal rep, I'm free of charge, I recently handed them their permanent resident ID cards. And as recognized Geneva Convention refugees, they have escaped the poll tax so far. But now they will face it in that they will have to pay £1,300 sterling each if they want British citizenship. And if their newly born son, Jude, had been born now, he would have been born British. But as he was born last week before they got their status, it seems they will have to naturalize him at a cost of a further £1,000 and a lot of bureaucracy. So they have a bill of £3,600. Another client, Hajara from Nigeria, arrived pregnant from the Lebanon, as it happened, the war in Lebanon, in 2007, so that her son, Michael, was born in the UK and was in fact eligible for registration as a British citizen at the age of 10 in 2017. But Hajara has never been able to afford this until now. It costs £1,000. She is not a convention refugee, but one of a larger population granted so-called discretionary leave on a long 10-year route to permanent resident status, divided into 2.5-year slices. And it's marked by 4 poll tax or fee payments of £2,000 per person per time, regardless of age or condition. So that's £4,000 for her and Michael, totaling for them over the 10 years, £16,000. She got this status under the rules when Michael reached 7 years of age in 2014. There are no terms and conditions, but she can escape either by making out a complicated case for a fee waiver, for which she would have to pay a solicitor if it weren't somebody like me. She succeeded in that in 2016, but failed last year. Or she can make further submissions as a person who was previously refused refugee status, which is free. We've had to do the latter, but making these free submissions is treated as an interruption of her 10-year route march to permanent settlement. So now, while the Home Office are mulling over her case in a process which may take 6 to 12 months or more, she has the right to stay, but she has lost her job because the employers are told that she's no longer entitled to work. She's lost her job as a low-paid care worker, despite the huge need for such people in this pandemic. The only concession has been to grant her just enough welfare benefit to survive under the universal credit scheme in this country. In the hostile environment with its neo-poll tax, the path to citizenship is long and hard and disempowering. Dehumanization can only be arrested to some extent by the intervention of charity lawyers like myself and allied welfare workers. There are all too few of us, and agonizingly, we often fail to buck the system. It's a system based on a targeted hostile environment. And what's more, it was adopted by professing Christians, Theresa May and David Cameron. To rephrase Lord Acton's famous dictum about the corruption of power, we can say that all management targets tend to dehumanize, absolute targets dehumanize absolutely. Thank you very much, everyone.
So thank you, David, for describing that. What's really happening now makes us very worried. This is already stage three. You've taken away the basic human rights of people in our country.
Yeah, so this crucifixion machine is still at work. We continue to dehumanize migrants, refugees, Black people, women, LGBT, and there's probably many other categories, Andrew. What other things are happening? How is this being lived out today?
I heard the story of how children are held in cages in the United States, children of in migrant detention centers. It's a harrowing, dreadful story. The murder of George Floyd helps us realize the endemic systematic brutality against Blacks in the States and in Britain. However, the Black Lives Matter and the Me Too movement are positive protests that are also changing things. So in these two movements, for instance, they're protests against Crucifixion Friday, but they're pointing to Easter Sunday is coming. They're disrupting the crucifixion machines. And we perhaps should use plural. There are lots of crucifixion machines. It's not just one.
Mm. So is there any hope? How do we, either a faith community or simply compassionate people wishing to resist these forces of dehumanization, what hope is there for us?
So I found hope when I was in Lviv. So during the day with Miles and his sister, Meryl, and Peter and Marie, we were going around remembering the story in East West Street. And at night, I was reading a book produced by Andrew Lane, a Quaker at the Brussels European Quaker Center, on hate speech. And he gave me hope by saying, what we do to counter hate speech is tell an alternative story. So the first spiritual tool in our collection of tools for disrupting the crucifixion machine, disrupting the genocide process, is to tell alternative stories. So one series of stories, I'm just going to give headlines, is all humans are made in the image of God. Humans are of equal worth. Stories that illustrate love your neighbor as yourself, or great is the worth of all souls in the sight of God. And we also tell stories that point to the real issue. The real issue is not migrants or refugees or gay people who are being blamed for our current problems, unemployment, low wages. It's an economy that benefits the billionaires, not all people. In the Bible Exodus story, God's on the side of slaves. We tell the story of how Jesus stands in the Exodus tradition of justice for the poor. We tell the story of how the early Christians in Jerusalem lived all things in common, economic equality. We remind people that there are 2,000 verses in the Bible that are critical of poverty. That's quite a few verses. And we tell the story of the development of human rights for all. Human rights can bring people together, faith, humanists, and others that may not have a religious faith, but have compassion nevertheless for their fellow humans. And we're all allies in a common cause then. So human rights are rights that you're born with. They can't be sold, bought, or taken away. And in the United States, we can remind people of the Declaration of Independence, a document that is like scripture for Americans. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all people are created equal, that they're endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So I want to suggest to American listeners that if you don't believe or support this, you're not a real American. And if you are a politician who does not support policies that assume all people are created equal, then you're betraying America. So even the American founding story is a story that we can tell. And then we can also tell stories of resistance that hindered or stopped or prevented the Holocaust, that disrupted the crucifixion machine. In Denmark, nearly all the Jews were protected and escaped to safety. In Italy, 80% of all Jews survived, compared with only 23% in Germany. The French village of La Chambon, of 5,000 people, a people led by a Christian pastor who believed in the Sermon on the Mount, saved in World War II 5,000 people, 3,000 of whom were Jews, and got them to safety 200 or 300 kilometers away over the Swiss border. So genocide is not inevitable. Crucifixion can be stopped, prevented, halted by ordinary people. You and I can make a difference.
Tell me a little bit about what you've just said and nonviolence, because in terms of stories I've heard of how World War II ended, there was a lot of violence involved. But some of the stories you just told obviously were some nonviolent ways, you know, protection or hiding of people or ways that they were able to help Jews continue to live throughout that experience. So tell me a little more, if you don't mind, about the importance of nonviolence, because I know that's a big deal for you.
So I love the story of Shipra and Pura, two midwives ordered by Pharaoh to kill the baby boys, the Hebrew baby boys as they're born, and they refuse to do it. And Pharaoh's annoyed, calls the women to give an account of why aren't they doing that, and they make up some excuse. So they didn't participate. They were civilly disobedient. Now, they didn't raise an army. They weren't a physical threat to Pharaoh. They just disobeyed him. And their names are still remembered over 3,000 years later. I love that part of the story. So civil disobedience is about divine obedience. So it's first of all about obeying God and obeying the recognition that all humans are of worth and should be treated as such. So the village of La Chambon, for instance, if they had been a resistance group, they would have been killed, murdered by the Nazis straight away. Because their resistance was nonviolent, subtle, quiet, not obvious, sometimes Andrei Trochme, the pastor, would get a phone call with a German accent telling him, raid coming tomorrow. So somebody in the German hierarchy or bureaucracy was sympathetic to what was going on in La Chambon and could support it by that anonymous phone call because the group was nonviolent. So I find that intriguing. If the Danish government was already defeated militarily, if they tried to attack and assassinate and so on, they wouldn't have been able to carry out their work of saving the Jews. So it's de-escalation whilst upping the disobedience.
Recently, hundreds of thousands of people have taken to the streets to go out and protest for racial justice after the killing of George Floyd. And, you know, most of that happened in nonviolent ways. There are some media sources that are trying to uplift the violence that happened, but almost all over the world, these were nonviolent ways of people demonstrating for humanization, for the rights of people. How important is that?
I'm reading a book written in 2011 by Chenoweth and Marie Stanton, and they look at over 300 incidents of rebellion, if you like, and over 100 of them are nonviolent. The others are violent revolutions. And they found, looking at this data, that if it's a nonviolent revolution, it will succeed on average 54% of the time. if it's a violent revolution, half that rate of success. And then if you look at the outcomes after the revolution in terms of movement to democracy and human rights, it happens 4% of the time or less with a violent revolution. It happens nearly all the time with nonviolent revolutions. So the outcome is much better with nonviolence. So we have to take seriously the option of nonviolence. I want to go back and say also there's another group of stories that we should be telling. The stories of accountability. Judgment is coming. And there were the Nuremberg trials after World War II. There are now international laws, international courts, and as Martin Luther King preached, the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. So it's important to recognize that people now can be held accountable. And that's an important story to tell as well.
Yeah, and so one of the results of that for World War II, for example, was international law then beginning to lift up the rights of not only individuals, but groups of persons. And tell more about that. I think there's more about that from Philippe Sands in East West Street, right?
Yeah. So remember, Philippe Sands is an international lawyer who can write as well as John Le Carré. So he writes brilliantly the story of two lawyers, both of whom studied law in Lviv, Ukraine. And he has a connection with Lviv because his granddad was born there. So it's a personal story for him. And he finds this out. He unwraps this story. So one of these two lawyers was Hirsch Lauterpacht, and he rooted international law and individual rights. He got to Cambridge, England. He escaped to Cambridge, England before the war. And he was very influential in the Nuremberg trials after World War II. And Raphael Lemkin, also a student in the law department at Lviv University, is the one who created the idea of group rights, who invented the term genocide, that also became part of international law after World War II. And now we have international laws and courts to prevent mass murder and genocide. And we must protect these gains. It's really important.
Yeah. I looked up the word genocide, and it came up that Raphael Lemkin had created that word. I found it really interesting because it's a combination of two language derivatives. So the first part is Greek, the geno that we find there for people, and then the side part for killing comes from, you know, the word homicide, for example, has a Latin root. So I thought it was very interesting that there are two groups of people within this one word, that it didn't have just one, it didn't come from one place, but this whole idea of the other and what does it mean to live together with others and to see people as more a part of us as opposed to dehumanizing them and putting people into other categories and classification, symbolization, and dehumanization that leads to eventually genocide. Andrew, we are in really extremely polarized political times. And lately we've heard all of these phrases such as hashtag Black Lives Matter, LGBTQ plus rights, masks or no masks. And almost immediately for some people, saying these things or hearing these things elicits some type of response within them that almost immediately identifies people and their responses with either the right or left politically. And I've actually seen you sit down and write letters to political leaders. This seems to be one method of advocacy to bring attention to the concerns of dehumanization in the world. But it seems to be a strategy that works best in what we might consider to be functional democracies. So one of my questions is does that even exist anymore? Do we have functional democracies? Many of the names you gave were from countries that seem to be democracies, but are they functional anymore? And is letter writing still effective? Or is there potentially something more that needs to be done? Can we count on our traditional methods within today's democracies to be able to respond.
So, yeah, I think I've been to Parliament. I've been to Congress. I walked past John Kerry's door. I saw a presidential candidate taking a group of constituents around. I went in and lobbied, and nobody came for me at midnight to beat me up or threaten my family in the United States. So you can still do that. You don't need protection. It's part of free speech. We understand that. So we don't have to fight for that in many of our countries. What we do have to fight against is apathy and energy to do something to make a difference. So it's, you know, the idea that enough feathers can sink a ship, enough grains of sand can outweigh a ton. So our voices matter, our witness matters. So I think we should use the democratic opportunities that we're gifted with as citizens of our respective countries. And we're lazy if we don't.
Interesting. Tell more about what our tasks might be to not get back to Auschwitz.
So Europe, I feel really positive about Europe. It has this dreadful history. And then I went and worked in Germany as a student and was treated totally humanely as another human. They didn't stereotype me. They teased me. They were kind to me. They treated me as a human. I became a European in Europe, in Germany, working in Germany. Yeah. And I think in Europe, in the British Isles, after World War II, you had the welfare state come in. I went to college, which was basically a free ride, even though I was from a poor family. So things got better and better in Europe. It's been a miracle. And the European Union has been this amazing peace project that has prevented World War III happening in Europe. That's immensely important. My grandfather's generation fought World War I. My dad's generation fought World War II. I didn't have to fight World War III, which would have been the last war, perhaps, of all things. So what's our task? Out of the gratitude that I feel for being European, our task, I think, is to make Auschwitz the heart of Europe, like Christians make the cross the heart of Christianity. Auschwitz is God's agony. Our task is to make sure it never happens again. And as community of Christ, we have this growing commitment to always protect the most vulnerable. Now in Europe, we have the Council of Europe, we have the European Convention on Human Rights, and the accountability to the Strasbourg-based European Court of Human Rights. And it's really important that we protect these initiatives that came into being after the darkness of World War II. They're part of the Easter morning light in Europe, if you want to put it that way. So there's talk in Britain, though, in the dynamics of Brexit, of leaving these things. And I think we will be more vulnerable because of that. And so we must take a stand before it's too late. And we must join with others who are also concerned. We're working already with the Quakers who were actually born in a hostile environment 3.5 centuries ago. We hang out with friends in Church and Peace that has a European-wide vision. We are seeking to build bridges with Buddhists and Jains who, like Quakers, have a nonviolent tradition. And we join hands with those Sikhs, Muslims, and Hindus who also want our societies to be good for everyone's children. And we need to be particularly sensitive in our relationships with the Jewish community, which over 2,000 years has suffered so much pain in so-called Christian Europe. Our task is to make sure Auschwitz never happens again. We raise that as our goal. And we join with others to make sure that doesn't happen because we're not strong enough to do that by ourselves. So I want to say others exclude, divide, build walls. We include, reach out, build bridges. All of us want a good world for our children and grandchildren. In Nepal, when I was working there, I met the former ambassador to Britain, a real gentleman. And in retirement, he was working with perhaps 500 charities, not-for-profits, NGOs for fair elections in Nepal, which, by the way, have happened. I asked him, was it dangerous work for him? Was it a risk? And he smiled, no. When you're working with 500 other organizations, the government dare not do anything against me. There's safety in numbers, he said. With others, we can be a force for good. So that's why allying with others in civil society is so important. And we can learn so much from the Quakers. From the beginning, they lobbied. So George Fox sometimes persuaded the judge that he stood before to do justice rightly. George Fox and other Quakers spoke with Oliver Cromwell and got a hearing and were heard. And the same when Charles II came on the throne of England after 1660. So the fact that the Quakers were nonviolent and kept telling their respective governments that they were nonviolent meant their voice could be taken seriously. They weren't dangerous, but they were lobbying for change. So it's the same in the United States today, as well as in Britain. We can lobby safely. And you asked about letter writing earlier. So I learned 35 years ago that when a politician gets a letter, a phone call, or today an email, they think 1,000 other constituents are thinking like this. So that's always empowered me. And 8 letters is a big post bag for a senator, a representative, or a member of parliament. They represent 8,000 people. So just a few people can make a big difference. And it only takes one other person to help me be much more courageous. So with you or with Elray or Andrew Fellows, for instance, I'm much more courageous. I'm able to do far more than I would by myself.
So if the goal, Andrew, is to move away from dehumanization and genocide, what is it that we're moving towards?
So it's the idea of Zion, or Martin Luther King's The Beloved Community, or God's peaceable kingdom of God on earth, where all have dignity, where we're all skilled and committed to reconciliation, and where war, violence, poverty, and economic injustice are history. Zion is where humanization happens, where human dignity is practiced. It's an old hope.
Hmm. Yeah. And you've talked about a 10-stage process that leads to genocide. This is Dr. Stanton's stages from genocidewatch.com. Is there an alternative to that, Andrew? Is there an opposite process of humanization or rehumanization, maybe?
Yeah, I think so. So rehumanization begins with listening, hearing people's stories of pain, taking the hurt seriously. And I love the story in Exodus 3, in the burning bush story, where the Holy Spirit confronts Moses. And Moses hears God say, "I've heard the cries of my people. I have seen their suffering. I've come down to deliver them." So rehumanization begins by listening. And it's interesting to play with the 8 Beatitudes, the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, and to see an opposite process to Dr. Stanton's 10 stages to genocide. So let me just go through those quickly. Blessed are the poor in spirit. So we begin by listening to the story of the dehumanized. Blessed are those that mourn. Blessed are those that mourn for the pain of others and realize that sometimes we participated in creating that pain by being a perpetrator or a bystander, not doing anything to stop it. Blessed are the meek, the humble who are willing to learn new ways, to repent, to use traditional language. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for justice, for righteousness, who are hungry to humanize, not dehumanize. Blessed are the merciful, who seek the recovery and healing of victims and also of perpetrators. God's grace is for all. We all dehumanize. We all need mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, who act without mixed motives and long only for the humanization of all. Blessed are the peacemakers. And peacemakers are people who dismantle and prevent and disrupt the road to Holocaust, genocide, economic injustice, systems of violence. Peacemakers are those people who prevent future crucifixions and genocides. And then it ends with the last beatitude. Blessed are those who stand up for justice, for humanization, no matter the cost. And blessed are those who see Jesus, the Jew, as one who always humanized, who gave dignity to women, children, the sick and crippled, the mentally ill, and even reached out in blessing to Roman officers and tax collectors like Matthew and Zacchaeus, who promised paradise to a thief on the cross beside him and forgave those below him who had nailed him to the wood. So these beatitudes create a people who then become salt, light, a city on a hill where all humans have dignity. So yes, the beatitudes are the opposite process of rehumanization or humanization, the opposite of Dr. Stanton's 10 steps.
Wow, the way you've just lifted up the beatitudes, you know, really, especially in light of dehumanization, what we've just spoken about gives us a way forward. It gives us a way out. That's one of the things I love about the stories of Jesus, is Jesus seems to find ways out of the current situations of dehumanization, of destruction that we're in. It would be wonderful if all of this was in some type of book that we might be able to read more on the subject of the Sermon on the Mount. Do you know anything more about that? Can you share anything about that?
So I've been working. I wrote one on the Sermon on the Mount 20 years ago that sold well in Herald House. But I've learned some things since then. So really, this is a 30-year project. And in this version, I do a commentary that people can do personally on each part of the Sermon on the Mount, a day at a time, perhaps. And then I tell stories of people who've lived out the Sermon on the Mount, some of whom we've touched on today. The village of Le Chambon is one of them.
Wow. I look forward to that being available for our listeners.
In the meantime, can I suggest the Bible?
Wonderful. Great option. Thank you, Andrew. The theme of the webinar was dehumanization yesterday and today, how to act as neighbor. So can you give us a little summary of how ordinary people can act as neighbor?
So Jesus said there were two great commandments. Sometimes we overlook them because we're so familiar with them. The first was to love God, and the second was to love your neighbor as yourself. So why love God? Because our neighbors and ourselves are created in the image of God. So when we love our neighbor, we're worshiping God. The two go together. And a simple thing to do is to greet everybody in your neighborhood and get to know them. Be friendly at work. Get to know everybody. Treat each person equally at your place of work or in your school. Obey the 11th commandment. Do not stereotype. And there's a 12th commandment. Do not be a bystander. Don't watch it happen. So civil disobedience, as I already mentioned, is about disobeying laws and orders that dehumanize others. And civil disobedience is divine obedience because it's protecting the dignity of every human being. Now, the village of Le Chambon, who saved 5,000 people, these villagers didn't have theology degrees. Most had left school at the age of 12. But they did know, love your neighbor as yourself. It was above the door as they went into church. And the important thing is, it wasn't only an idea. It was something that had become a reflexive habit. They didn't, in fact, have to think about it. It had become a habit, an instinct that they had adopted. So they were living out, great is the worth of souls in the sight of God, which is a central value of the restoration. So I've been exploring the worth of souls, what's the race or the gender or the sexual orientation or religion of a soul?
Maybe we could have a future podcast on the soul and what is the race, gender, sexual orientation, or even religion of a soul. Fascinating. Well, is there anything else, Andrew, that you wanted to mention in this podcast? Anything that has come to your mind as we've taken time to explore these topics today?
Thank you, Joey, for the opportunity. It's very simple, I think. I mean, I'm not a complicated person in the end. It's the worth of souls is great in the sight of God. Love your neighbor as yourself. We're all made in the image of God. There are stories, empowering stories, of people who've disrupted and prevented the crucifixion machine.
Thank you so much, Andrew. Thank you for being a part of this follow-up podcast to the 2020 European Peace Colloquy webinar series. And we also want to thank your friends, Miles and David, for their contribution and letting us use their clips in this podcast. Thank you for your time and your important reflections on dehumanization and how we might respond and change the direction from genocide, destruction, and war towards diversity, inclusion, and peace. And thank you to all of our listeners. Please join us next time to listen to Zach McLaughlin share about action teams as we all continue to explore together our many different grounds for peace.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use, and while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.